You know, we're not talking about any Sony movies.
Talking about ISIS.
Stop.
On the program.
Stop saying ISIS.
I can't. It just keeps coming out of my mouth.
Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my regular co-host, Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And my regular co-host as well, because he's regularly here, Cassidy Robinson. I'm not going to say where you're from. I'm done with it.
I'm from Los Angeles. So I'll do it for you. No pressure. You did things last week?
Yeah, I didn't do the show. I just was like, no, I'm out.
And yeah, I tried to find a replacement. I almost had friend of the show Keith Foster on, and we had kind of a plan set up, and I just couldn't really. There was basically nothing in the theaters last week. It was a really bad week.
It was a garbage week, yeah.
It was a garbage week. The only movie that was playing was a Bourne sequel, and I was also broke, and so this probably isn't going to make it on the podcast, but we almost recorded a podcast like a top 10 kind of thing. And I was like, I hate everything about this already. So I just was like, I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. But
people love lists though. We used to do lists all the time.
We did. And it was going to kind of be that, but it was too broad. And I thought I could make it better. The whole plan was just kind of rushed and whatever, but
I sometimes the mother, you know, I like doing rush things sometimes. I think it's that makes kind of it more creative. It's like the mother of all invention.
Being rushed is the mother of all invention, not the band, the Canadian hard rock band Rush.
Oh, I see what you did there. It could be. You don't know that. For some people, there's probably somebody out there. Every time they need to, they put on a little Rush and it gets them there.
You know what?
If I'm thinking of the right band, because I get them mixed up with somebody else, but I like them. It's the other band that I get them mixed up with that I don't like.
Right. Tom Sawyer, Geddy Lee.
That one's good. I like Rush. Rush is fine. It's the one that does, I think it's Journey. Journey is the one. I get those two mixed up in my head.
Don't Stop Believing?
Yeah, I don't.
But everyone likes that song.
Well, I mean, kind of.
Like, it's sort of unanimously, ubiquitously, even though they play it on the radio to this day, they play Don't Stop Believing on the radio about 300 times a day at any given time. So it hasn't waned. And I hate that kind of music, that whole like bloated 70s arena rock.
Sure.
But there's something about that song that kind of transcends its genre.
Just that one song, though.
Yeah, like, fuck Journey.
Yeah, but fuck the rest of Journey, yes. Like, as long as that's being said, I'm fine.
I don't care about the rest of their catalog, but for whatever reason, that one song just kind of works. Who was it? There was on the AB Club. AB Club does that undercover series.
Yeah, you've made me read that once or twice.
No. Not the... it's not an article series. They do a little web series called AV Club Undercover, where they have bands come in and cover famous songs.
Okay, yeah.
And it's from a list that they have to choose from. So they might end up, depending on when they come in, they might end up having to do, you know, Highway to the Danger Zone. even if that's not at all in their wheelhouse. So you get some interesting stuff. It's kind of a mixed bag, but, early on, when they first started the project, kind of a alt-country band called Clem Snide covered Journey's Don't Stop Believing, but Faithfully, which is like a ballad. And it's a super stripped-down ukulele cover, and it's just the guy in his voice. And it was so good and so weirdly powerful that they ended up doing like a whole EP of acoustic Journey covers and their style.
Hmm.
But yeah, this isn't a music podcast. Today we're going to be talking about Suicide Squad. And at the end of the program, we're going to review from Netflix The Explorers, an old 1980s kids flick.
From Joe Dante.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the movie news, and I'm going to start with this story. I guess I might as well start with this because this is open on my browser. James Ponsoldt is teaming with Disney for his ambitious first studio film, Wild City. I'm reading this on IndieWire. James Ponsoldt, the director of The End of the Tour and The Spectacular Now. Indie guy. I've really liked his output, and I really like his writing style and his directing style is very subtle, very character-oriented. But he's going to be doing a big kind of CGI live-action hybrid adventure film for Disney, but it's based on an original idea. So this isn't, you know, it's not John Carter in the sense that he's not, like, taking on some old IP that they have lying around.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It could be sort of in that vein, that sort of old, like back when Bruckheimer used to produce for them.
Well, that's what I was kind of, and I don't mind like a new original adventure. Just them saying an original content, you go, oh my gosh. You get almost excited just because they say original. And I mean, that's partially the only reason we're covering it. Right. I swear I read a little synopsis of what it was about somewhere else, but we couldn't find that. So I don't know. Again, he seems like a good director. I actually think that Disney is in a bad one to kind of break your teeth into the studio system with, especially if you're an independent person, because they just have such a machine.
Right. It's
and, I don't know. It kind of sounds cool. And I could see, like, I mean, and, you know, CG gets a bad rap, especially from, like, film reviewers and critics and stuff like that now. But at the same time, I could see something, you know, when, you know, like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of weird CG adventure kind of thing like that, I think could be a lot of fun. So it just depends on what he's bringing to the table. But the fact that they're giving, you know, an indie darling some money to make a original content, I think that that's kind of cool. And that's something that we've, you know, everybody's been bitching about anyways.
Yeah, I'm hesitantly interested. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that Disney is like an evil, you know, I mean, they're a little evil.
All corporations are a little evil.
Yeah, and I mean, so in that sort of base sense, they are, you know, the Antichrist. But outside of that, like, as far as just as movie studios go, I don't think they're the worst. And like you said, they do a pretty good job at sort of giving people a shot. Certainly with their Marvel movies, they've been doing that. Of course, you hear different things from different directors.
Well, Pixar as well.
Pixar as well. That again, is a very collaborative. All their animated films are so collaborative that's really hard to kind of say it's any one person's vision.
Well, like, yeah, and they kind of have to anyways.
It's yeah. Like, and I imagine big films like this probably are too, but I'm interested to see what he brings to it because his voice is so, so not flashy. It's not what I would think of as an adventure film director, but maybe that's what he's trying to prove himself against.
Well, I mean, also, I guess, yeah, kind of you can go in the opposite direction, but also, like, who is the guy? I think he did Anna Karenina and then he did Pan, and Pan was Universal flop, so it can backfire that.
Yeah, Joe Wright, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He also did Hannah, which I loved.
Oh, he did Hannah as well? I did like him a lot. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's interesting just because of the original property. So we'll keep an eye out, and when more kind of comes to light, maybe we can bring it up again.
Sure. What do you got?
John Carahan?
Carnahan?
Carnahan.
Joe? Guy,
he's recently been sourced to adapt Uncharted, which is a video game, for the Sony PlayStation that follows this, I believe his name is Jonathan Drake, or something of that nature. And he's this Indiana Jones / bank robber type.
Yeah, it's Doc Savage-y type video game.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that specifically, I do like Joe Carnahan. I think he brings kind of a good sense of humor, and he's good at doing this type of genre. And so if Sony lets him be and kind of does his thing, I think it could be interesting. Because even something like, what was that movie we watched a little bit ago? We did it for Netflix homework. Had Chris Pine and...
Stretch.
Stretch, that was the movie.
With Chris Pine, and who else was in that? Patrick Wilson.
Patrick Wilson.
Yeah. Which was like kind of like, it didn't like all the way work, but it was sort of a labor of love kind of personal project.
And it was kind of an interesting, even though it was a little bit of a mess, it was an interesting mess.
Sure.
And something that I think he always does really well in his films, The Gray and,
Yeah, that was a kind of underrated movie.
Smoking Aces is the other one. There's a lot of hate for that one too, and I don't understand why, because I thought that was a lot of fun. But
yeah,
he always has these interesting characters in them. So I'm kind of somebody who's going to take a property and kind of mold actual like people. So I could see this working out in their favor. How do you feel about this?
Well, Joe Carnahan is, I'm more or less pro Joe Carnahan. I feel like you definitely know what you're getting with him. Although I will say, even with that said, The Gray really was a big surprise. Cause I wouldn't necessarily say that that's a lot like his other films. It's kind of, a slow burn.
But well, it's also, it came out in that Liam Neeson, I'm gonna find you and kill you period.
Right, exactly. So I kind of thought it was going to be one of those, and it wasn't. But there's three strikes against this project. One being, the only other time we've seen Joe Carnahan do a movie based on an original or a known IP was when he did A-Team.
Yeah.
And okay. So there's that.
You've made a good point there. Go on.
The other one being, it's a video game movie, and I know we got later this year, the
Assassin's Creed.
The Assassin's Creed movie is going to come out, which looks promising. I'm still not super hyped for it, but, you know, if they can crack the code, we'll see.
At least as good as Mortal Kombat. At least as good.
that bar is so low. Like, really, honestly, people our age, 25 to 30 years old, and you still talk about Mortal Kombat like it's a really good film, go watch it again, really. And then lastly, fuck Sony.
Right.
They are a mess. They are a hot mess. You know, ever since the whole, like, email leak, and Amy Pascal, and then, like, them trying to do a Spider-Man universe and then kind of giving up on it, but maybe they're still going to try and do a Venom movie by themselves, and them, like, being really stingy with the properties they buy, but then they rush scripts to, you know, come out, and then they end up like Ghostbusters, which, you know, you go listen to our review if you really want to know how we felt about that. Yeah, I think they are just the most ramshackle big studio out there, and I can't believe that they haven't just completely turned over their entire staff.
They might be getting there. I think some of them, they do definitely need some new blood.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Marvel kind of influence, though, might do them a little bit good, at least for Spider-Man. I'm going to assume there, at least. I'm going to be hopeful for that.
For Spider-Man Homecoming. Exactly. Yeah, I feel like that's going to be fine because they're not working by themselves. There's an infrastructure there that kind of is going to help them along. But I'm talking about
them out on their own and
doing these kinds of movies. Like, you know, they just sort of buy these properties, don't know what the fuck to do with them.
I don't think that this is the thing, is I do think they have been shook up, and I think you're right. For the last little bit, they've kind of had a hard time finding their footing. I think Universal was in the same place a few years back.
They kind of still are.
They sort of still are, but I think they've settled in. We make Fast and Furious. We make Jurassic World. We make this type, you know, this type of blockbuster.
Right. Which
I'm kind of like, okay, you've at least found some footing-ish. But I think this is happening in general too, because we could argue further in our reviews, that there are several companies that are struggling to find their footing. So it's kind of hard to say, like, with Sony specifically in this project, because it is Uncharted's a little interesting because it's a PlayStation original property,
right?
So, and it's very popular within that video game realm. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, when we're kind of looking at how video game companies look at their properties being adapted, it leaves you a little bit like a kind of a leeriness towards the properties in general. So I don't know. This Sony, that's a little sketchy. The fact right. that it's on this property, it seems like it's a good fit for this writer and director. So I don't know. It's one of those shaky where you're like, oh, sure. We'll see what happens in a couple of years.
Yeah, and it doesn't even say that he's going to direct. It just shows right. that he's writing it.
Which so. I think he's a good writer, too. I mean, honestly, yeah. I think that he has an interesting voice as a writer. And mm-hmm. and talking about the new age of cinema, that's something that the most of the studios could need. We need a little bit less movies by committee. So
I agree with that. He's kind of like, his voice is kind of somewhere in between Shane Black and John McTiernan, who'd made Predator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he do Die Hard as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can agree with that. Somewhere in there, he's kind of got that quirkiness to his mm-hmm. characters. I always like when he has really weird characters.
specifically Chris Pine doing anything.
Yeah, Chris Pine in any of his movies is fine. I'm surprised Chris Pine didn't play an actual wolf in The Gorilla. That would have been amazing, right?
That would have been the best. All right. I'm going to do this story, and then we're going to call the news done. Bradley Cooper and Todd Phillips is turning their an ISIS book, Black Flags, has nothing to do with the hardcore band, into an HBO miniseries. So Todd Phillips and Bradley Cooper worked together on the Hangover movies,
mm-hmm.
the Hangover trilogy. And actually, they're working together again this year. There's that movie with Jonah Hill and Miles Teller, and they're like selling arms, and Bradley Cooper's in that. Yeah, I think that comes out later this month, maybe.
Yeah, I think it might be next week.
Yeah.
No. Next week is Sausage Party. Then it's the week after.
Right. So, you know, I have mixed to negative feelings on the Hangover thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the first one was like mildly amusing for what it was. For a Dude Where's My Car meets Very Bad Things ripoff, mm-hmm. and everyone kind of forgot those movies existed, so everyone thought it was like the Jesus of comedic cinema. And then I really, really hated Hangover 2. I kind of liked his little Transplanes and Automobiles ripoff, Due Date.
It was okay.
It's fine for what it was.
I mostly thought his movies were okay, and I've mostly really enjoyed Zach Galifianakis.
Mm-hmm.
And his also another strange character.
But I'm interested to see what this War Dogs movie is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has a certain kind of sense of humor that's very biting
right.
and kind of mean-spirited, which can sometimes work against his comedies, depending on your disposition when you're watching them. But I feel like for a satire that's actually about something,
mm-hmm.
it could work to his benefit. So a lot of how I feel about this is going to depend on how I feel about that movie.
About where that might go. No, yeah. That makes sense, too. And I actually, every time I watch any of the, I only watched the first Hangover movie, but and also Due Date.
Right.
Actually, when I was watching both those movies, I was like, I actually think he'd be way better at a kind of like dramedies, like mm-hmm. and more like drama than comedies. And then I kind of thought about some of kind of the violence in his movies. And so this War Dogs does actually seem somewhat promising to me.
Mm-hmm.
And everything I see about it so far, kind of, I'm like, I can kind of get behind this. So, him doing an ISIS movie with,
B Coops,
you know how I feel about ISIS. So I think it could be good.
Wow. You just couldn't help yourself.
I, It was topical.
Yes. The coda at the end of this entire thing. I mean, I think you've probably seen, it's a movie I haven't seen, but everyone else in the world has, Old School.
I did see that.
Yeah, that was a Todd Phillips joint as well.
I liked that back then, but I was like 16. And
right. It's kind of one of those hard to tell.
All those kind of things.
Yeah. However, I just barely saw his first ever feature, which was the G.G. Allen documentary Hated.
Oh.
So that's still in my brain and will never be washed out.
Well, that's interesting. This Todd Phillips is an interesting fellow, at least.
Right. And I watched the documentary. I guess more it's just as like, well, you know, I try and watch a lot of these punk documentaries that are sort of important. Mm-hmm. I knew that he did it, but I didn't really like think of like his voice too much about it. Mm-hmm. But when I watched it and then I like thought about it in context to what he's known for in his comedies, I'm like, there is a through line here. Like, even though this is a documentary and he's just kind of showing G.G. Allen being G.G. Allen, his kind of sympathy for that sort of character, you know, does kind of echo into his narrative comedies.
Self-destructive kind of individuals.
Right. And sort of the scatological stuff and...
Well, there's G.G. Allen. I can't even talk about him. It just makes me want to shower.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm vaguely interested in this miniseries. I think it could be cool.
I do, too.
Well, and I like Bradley Cooper. We haven't talked about him, but he's generally pretty good.
He has a thing, and I think under the right guidance, I think he can be very good in his roles. But I think he has to have a strong guide, because even say what you will about like American Sniper.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was pretty good in that too, and it was because he had somebody that really knew the ropes and could send him through. Whereas I think in some of the Todd Phillips movies, he's been hit and miss.
And I'd see every movie he was bad in, I never thought it was his fault, even when I had no reason to believe that he was any better than that.
What about The Words?
Oh, that movie's so fucking awful.
Yes. I remembered the name. I'm so glad.
So him and Zoe Saldana, pre-Guardians of the Galaxy.
I had it in my back pocket just ready for you.
Oh, yeah, that one was pretty bad. But again, he wasn't necessarily... what made it bad, other than like he literally is a reason it got made because it was like a friend of his and it was a favor.
See? See, he's bad. He needs guidance.
No, I kind of consider Bradley Cooper kind of reminds me of like a young, back when we gave a shit, Tom Cruise. Hmm. Like, he's this really good looking guy who a lot of people had a hard time taking seriously. I think he's a little better than Tom Cruise, but a lot of people have a hard time taking him seriously because of that. And he ends up being about as good as his director.
Right.
Generally speaking, but
no, that's a good comparison. I like that. That works.
Yeah.
I think he has a weird dark edge to him, just like Tom Cruise does.
Yeah.
Cause there are several movies where they want a part to make Tom Cruise sparkly clean, and I don't buy it. That's why I ended up liking like Edge of Tomorrow or Collateral or some of those when he's in those movies. Cause I'm like, yep, I buy that completely.
Right.
I think it's kind of similar-ish with Bradley Cooper.
Agreed. Although I think Bradley Cooper can play a romantic lead a little less, manically. Although I never saw All About Steve.
And I haven't seen All About Steve, but the one movie that comes to mind is he was literally a manic depressive in it. So,
oh yeah,
the most popular he's known for. So
I guess you're right.
Willem Dafoe, Death Note, bam, done.
He's gonna be voicing it. I don't know. It's an anime I didn't watch.
And Adam Wingard's gonna be directing it. That's why I'm interested. So, but I think it's a good. I think it's a nice little pairing, and I think it's shaping up to be something that I'd be interested in. So more on that in future episodes or whatever.
When it happens. Let's go ahead and get into Suicide Squad, which is written and directed by David Ayer, who did Fury a few years ago, which we reviewed on the show. And I also reviewed, I think, a solo review for his cop procedural End of Watch. Both movies that are kind of generally well-regarded for the genres that they are in. He likes ensembles. He likes, you know, really getting into the dirt with his characters and really getting into the muck of their world that they inhabit and how the world sort of ends up defining his characters, and vice versa. And he gets to do a little bit of that here with this big comic book adaptation from DC, Suicide Squad, which is kind of like Guardians of the Galaxy for the DC set. It's a team up of unlikely, do we want to say heroes? Anti-heroes, I guess.
I think you could say anti-heroes, but they're really supposed to be supervillains.
It's a supervillain, super team-up kind of thing.
To do something good.
Right. Well, forced into doing something good.
Yeah.
And in this, the characters, Will Smith plays Deadshot, which I think maybe is one of the more well-known of these villains. Oh, Killer Croc is pretty well-known if you're a Batman fan.
I think Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn is definitely well-known. She was invented in a cartoon and ended up infiltrating the comics due to her popularity in the cartoon, played by Margot Robbie here. Viola Davis is in here as Amanda Waller, this like shady FBI lady who gets
intelligence this, agent
or whatever, and gets all of these guys together, and she's the one who proposes this plan as sort of a last action. This is still in the same DC movie universe that they're trying to build here, so this does come after the actions of Batman v Superman, which came out later this year. So spoiler alert, Superman died at the end of that movie, and this one starts out with that. She's saying, hey, you know, the Superman is totally out of control. What if one of these metahumans decides they're just gonna like fuck shit up? We got to have something to fight them, and it has to be something on their level. And what better than insane, crazy, barely containable supervillains that we have in prison?
You're late.
Yogata.
This is Katana. She's got my back. She can cut all you in half with one sword stroke, just like mowing the lawn. I would advise not getting killed by her. Her sword traps the souls of its victims.
Harley Quinn, nice to meet ya. Love your perfume. What is that, the scent of death?
Koroska.
Whoa, easy, cowgirl. Ain't that kind of a mission. Have a seat.
She seems nice.
And, it kind of hits the ground running. Like, there's not a lot of lead up. You know, you're kind of briefly introduced to all these characters. And they're essentially thrown together into this group and forced, you know, by gunpoint and by a computer chip bomb injected into their neck to go on this mission, that's this crazy mission, or to save their city from a Aztec demon thing, possessing Cara Devigne? Devigne?
Sure.
What's the name of her character? She's like a thing in the comics.
Then
Enchantress, who was originally supposed to be part of this team and then sort of breaks off rogue when her evil magical powers that are sort of ill-defined ends up running amok and, you know, going out of control. And thus gives Amanda Waller a perfect excuse to break out her new Suicide Squad. Jared Leto's in there as the Joker as well.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think?
I was actually kind of okay with the first two-thirds. You kind of got these character dynamics and kind of this poppy music, and you kind of get this, it's a very basic setup. Here's right. These bad guys, they're going to be on a mission, send them into the worst of the worst, you know, this kind of A squad, alpha squad, kind of whatever thing, rogues and nefarious types.
Yeah.
And it was problematic. There was definitely some problematic stuff in the first two thirds as well. But I think this movie broadly kind of falls apart towards the last third and the last part of this chapter. I didn't have a problem with most of the people playing the characters, except I would. That's not true.
What?
No, Will Smith kind of bugged me at times. He seemed a little too
Will Smithy.
Will Smithy, nice guy to be playing a sociopath. I didn't buy it. But I mean, he genuinely did okay. Margot Robbie, 50% of the time I thought she was good. And then there was a good handful of lines that I was like rolling my eyes like, ugh. Like I usually don't make sounds and I was making ugh, ugh sounds in the theater. So that one was hard. Some of the other guys, they don't really necessarily expose enough that you can really
have an opinion.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I generally liked how they looked. I liked their little things. Let's see. What are the things that I thought were problematic specifically was I really thought a lot of the character motivations were very problematic in this because these are supposedly supervillains, sociopaths, the worst of the worst, right?
Mm.
But by the end, they're all doing these super heroic things and they're like caring for one another. And they're this like weird family dynamic that I don't think was earned at all. And it
right.
became, and that was very off and strange. But I feel like that there was two versions of those characters. Mm-hmm. There was the nicer comic book version. And then there was the meaner, gritty, actual villain version.
Right.
And depending on what scene you were watching, they would be those. And this movie did have scenes. It wasn't like Batman versus Superman, where it's just a bunch of things strung together. This actually had some like story movement. Mm-hmm. And it gets towards the end and it becomes, and again, I think it becomes very, very bad. And it becomes basically you have this weird Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters like esque thing happening, battling a supermodel.
I saw this with a friend and I whispered over her during the end of the movie. I was like, I didn't know we were getting two Ghostbusters remakes this year.
It also vaguely reminded me because of the facade of the building. It reminded me of the second one too, when they come in and they're fighting, what's his face? The big, Eastern European looking dude.
Right.
In the second film. I forgot his name right now, but I love those films. this film was a mixed bag. I don't think it's necessarily the worst thing that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I found some of it kind of entertaining and engaging. There's a slight tone deaf issue with some of the jokes and maybe racial stuff. I haven't fully decided on that. I actually thought that Jared Leto's Joker, and I'm half and half on Jared Leto. I thought that was fine.
I do too. And it's funny, like there's lots of things. This movie's kind of impossible to really kind of like put my finger on because every time I think I have an opinion about it, I can kind of always contradict that with something else. Because, I mean, I'll say this. I don't think it's a good movie. I think that it is occasionally entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some good ideas in this movie. The movie feels ravaged by bad editing. I feel like there is a longer cut. And unlike BVS, which I have no interest in seeing more of that.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a longer cut. It supposedly works better. I don't really care because I just have no interest in the aesthetics or the tone of that movie at all.
I have friends that have watched the extended version and not the theatrical version and still think that the extended version is garbage. Yeah. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Whereas this movie, I feel like kind of needed a longer cut. Like there's a lot of these characters, some of these side characters get no play really at all. And I guarantee there's more out there with them in it. Mm-hmm. There's some like kind of backstory stuff that's only hinted at, especially the Harley Joker stuff, which ends up being this kind of, somewhat important B plot in the movie.
Well, it's almost kind of, it's weird. It's a weird relationship and I do like it. Because it does feel vaguely like abusive, also very romantic at the same time.
Well, it's,
and so you have to look at it like it feels wrong, but also right.
It's fucked up. It's the way that their relationship should be portrayed. And I think that it's a thing that a lot of people are kind of turned off by if they're not familiar with these characters or that lore. But it is, I mean, in actuality, if you're presenting this in a film way with real people and not cartoons, it's going to come off as, you know, gray, to say the least.
Well, also, I feel like, again, not just the motivations of the characters, but the motivations of the filmmakers. You have to decide if you're going to make a film about villains, and you're going to make them actually villainous, which most of these characters are. They're cannibals and sadists and the worst of the worst. You've got to say that's what they are. That's what they have to be. Also play that fun comic right. book thing.
The movie definitely 100% has tone issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely, it's trying to have its cake and eat its too, as far as we want to be subversive and we want to be, you know, rude and, you know, whatever, like, but it also kind of wants to be like, it wants to be like an acceptable kind of Happy Meal toy kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And it can't really do both. And I think that really undercuts, you know, the team dynamic that we have here. Cause I kind of like the team. I kind of like the actors who are playing them. I actually think Margot Robbie kind of knocked out of the ballpark as far as what she was given to do. Unfortunately, she just wasn't given that much to do.
I don't know. There are lines in there that, oh.
That's not her. The writing's bad, but the dialogue is really cliched.
But there is a depth to her character. I can agree with that.
Yeah, she put a lot into it. And I think, like, if you're going to get somebody to play that character, which it could come off as extremely arch anyway, and does, I think she does that really well. And I,
but it should, like, I mean, right. super villains are, you know, they are serial killers and bank robbers and the worst of the worst.
Well, specifically Batman's super villains.
Well, yeah, especially his rogue gallery. But a lot of them are those things in our natural world turned up to like 15.
And right. I was really fine with Will Smith. I mean, I agree with you. Like, he's barely a villain in the way that he's portrayed in this. I mean, he's a hitman who does kill people for a living. And so, but yeah, the way he's played,
they deliver that. But there are scenes towards the end that I don't think are earned with him.
Well, there's an ending that isn't earned with the entire movie.
And why does he's supposed to be playing this sociopath person who's, there's only one person in the world that he cares about. But then all of a sudden he like gleans onto these other, like, I mean, I get the freaks and outcast thing that they were trying to play, but it didn't feel earned. But again, I do think that there is this weird, I feel like there's a lot of studio notes. I feel like that there was a lot of strange editing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's two versions of this movie that they were trying to make. And I think there's one of those movies that would have actually really worked. And I think that supervillain, I don't even think it, like, some people say it really has to be rated R. I don't think so. I don't think you have to show all the bloods and guts and all that kind of stuff, or the full out swearing or anything like that. But I do think you have to say, you have to embrace that these are, they are bad people. And I mean, there's different layers of if they're bad or how bad they are, you know. One of the characters who can shoot fire out of his hands kind of has this.
He's a dumb character. I mean, I get what they were going for with that character. Yeah. And the actor is putting as much into it as he can. But the way that it's portrayed doesn't really work. And you're supposed to believe, like, oh, he did this terrible thing. And, like, how can we ever, like, get on his side? And the movie's, like, trying to get you by the end of the movie to be like, oh, he's redeemed himself. But it doesn't work either narratively or really through the performance. So I in general had not a very positive response to that character.
I thought he was okay-ish. I think it was more delivery, and not his delivery, but the movie's delivery.
No, yeah, the movie's not doing him any favors. And I mean, okay, I saw a meme on Twitter that I thought was kind of funny, where they had the Batman Forever, Batman and Robin in this movie, and they said, finally, the trilogy is complete, or something like that. Because it's kind of true. Like, the way I felt about this movie is it felt like Batman Forever getting anally raped by natural born killers while the Spawn movie is in the corner jerking off.
Wow.
And I don't necessarily mean all of that in a bad way. It's kind of so, like, it's so, when the movie does work is when it gets so absurd and so over the top and so kind of like mean,
mm-hmm.
that when it tries to be subversive, it actually kind of sort of pops in an interesting way, because there's not a lot of movies within the superhero genre that are doing that. Even Deadpool, which came out earlier this year, which, if you want to compare the two, is a more successful film as a film.
Mm-hmm.
Even that one still essentially kind of rolls back on it, on itself and said, okay, well, it's a superhero movie with a bad guy and we got to get him at the end. And this movie does that too, but I felt like I could feel the seeds of like, oh, this is like Fury. This is a Guns of the Navarone type of story. The team has to get together and they have to plow through this, you know, explosion filled, deteriorating city until they get to a final climax. The only problem is twofold. You never really get a sense of the group dynamic, here because there's no sense of history. They're kind of thrown together in the beginning, and then by the end, they're supposed to have come through this thing, and they're supposed to have, you know, decided they're a family. And like you said, it just doesn't work with the amount of screen time that they have to do that. And the second problem being the plot is so dumb. Like, the characters are cool. The setting is cool. The aesthetics are what they are. I kind of gave myself over to it, but it is.
I didn't mind the cartooniness of the aesthetics personally, because I don't think because with some of these characters, I don't see another better way to do it.
No, in some ways it worked.
Because like when you did that with Nolan, there were complaints that I had about Nolan and how he would do some of the villains. And I was like, you're trying to do this, but you're muting it by doing this.
Right.
And so, like, if you take somebody like Bane, for example, like, or even the Scarecrow, I'm like, no, you got to lean into the character. Like, it is kind of campy, but there is a version of that does work on the big screen.
And I think that occasionally that works here. I'm talking more about the film's aesthetic.
Well, that jumps back and forth too much.
Right. It's all over the place from scene to scene. Basically, the problem being is, like, the movie is never all that subversive. It never really lives up to this whole idea of, like, villains in a villain's mind, in a villain's world, all this kind of stuff. Because at the end, it's just about them, like, fighting a bunch of CGI shit.
Yeah. I thought some of the, there were some weird moments and things in this that, there are a couple of parts with Enchantress specifically that I thought were actually kind of creepy and done well.
Mm-hmm.
Once the actress takes her turn later on, it gets.
Oh yeah, do we want to talk about Cara Devine and her weird belly dancing?
do we need? I mean, you summed it up right there. I mean, that is what it is. I mean, it's as silly as it sounds, folks. She glows a little bit too, don't
you? Lots of lightning, and yeah, the movie just totally goes on autopilot. Like whatever kind of audacity it had, and it can be an audacity that annoys you from frame one, and it has annoyed a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You can say that there is sort of like they're going for something, like there is a vision here, and they're doing something, but then it doesn't have the nerve to kind of live up to that, because the plot is essentially this Saturday morning cartoon kind of plot that really undercuts everything that's supposedly subversive about this, and it ends up being about a whole lot of nothing.
Well, see, and to me, I don't understand why they had this weird Ghostbusters ending when all they really had to do, it didn't have to be the Joker, but somebody of his level. Mm-hmm. They just had to have that guy in a tower, and it had to be really hard, and it had to be all these guys, and they just had to go in and take care of business. That's it. But instead, they had this weird convoluted, we're going to have these weird pimple-headed things and fuck it.
Yeah, they looked like putties. They reminded me of the putties from Power Rangers.
They were putties, you're
because
right.
Because they were completely disposable. Like, to me, it was like, I was like, once I saw, like, how easy they were to kill, like, Harley Quinn just kind of, like, takes a bat to their head and they explode. I was like, oh, okay, this is just superhero fodder.
That's when I started. There's definitely some video game interesting kind of logic in this one as well. Literally, like, rip those characters, them apart. But then Margot Robbie just hit him in the head and they were, like, dead. And I was like, oh, okay. So.
Yeah, the movie does feel video gamey. And not all the time in a good or bad way. But, like, to me, the movie felt like, especially with how kind of choppily edited it was. Because I really feel like there's a whole different movie lying on somebody's floor.
But agreed. A whole other tone, too.
A whole other tone of maybe a more subversive movie, maybe more story stuff as far as, like, some of these characters go. But it really it felt like video game cutscenes that were kind of, like, glued together into a narrative.
if you can believe everybody, if you can believe a lot of what the internet chatter is, then I completely think that this is, that is true about this film. I thought it before I even heard it all, though.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that that exists there as well, and on top of just being like, oh, this feels messy in that sort of way, and then hearing all that chatter, you're like, oh, okay. So going back to a conversation we were having earlier about Sony not finding footing, I don't think Warner Brothers has any fucking clue what they're doing.
No, it's a mess. It's another hot mess. And I feel a lot of that had to do with their, from the start, bad decision to have Zack Snyder heading all of this. And I feel like, again, from the start, like trying to compete with Marvel by doing it their way, they needed to come up with an entirely different model.
They needed to just do their version, their model. Mm. And I think they are sort of doing their way, but they're trying to rush it. I think that's actually the primary reason, is they're trying to push it, make it work. And that's not usually when you're like putting that much pressure. I don't think that works for films very well.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically if Warner Brothers was the company that when Harry Potter was going, mm-hmm. they were the Disney. Everybody said they had their shit together.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a successful property up and going that keeps going, people look at them as successful. But once you run out of those properties, it's interesting how fast these things are falling apart now. So to me, it's kind of a weird microcosm. And now we're not even talking about the film anymore because this is part of what is wrong with the film is the studio, and that's unfortunate. But when it comes to it, this is a kind of a weird movie to kind of review for me, because I am a comic book fan.
Mm.
There are certain things that I will nitpick more than a normal viewer maybe, and
sure.
there are things that I will completely let go. This film is so all over the place that I have a hard time being like, okay, there's this, and I kind of like this, but I don't like this, but I like
exactly.
this. And
every scene, I probably had a different opinion about it than the last.
Mm-hmm.
Like the movie is a mess, and sometimes I think it's a mess in an interesting way, and then in the end, it just becomes the most uninteresting, superhero cliche blah you've ever seen. But up until that point, the David Ayer stuff, I feel like his vision of these characters and this kind of Guns of the Navarone type story is interesting. I just wish he really got to make the movie that I think he wanted to make.
Well, when you were talking about Fury and it pushing through, another film that I was thinking of a lot at the first of the film was I was kind of thinking about how the plotting of Reservoir Dogs was working.
Sure, yeah.
And how you'd get this character with this character with this character, and you'd kind of layer it up until you had this, like, ending. And I felt like it was kind of doing that
Ayer is definitely a student of Tarantino. I feel like his voice is very informed by that.
Sure. But, but we have a very similar view on specifically that portion where it's at the 2/3 mark.
Whatever was kind of working, like, totally falls apart by that point. And that, you know, that's all, unfortunately, that's the most, like, cohesive part of the movie, because the rest is just a big jumble of aesthetics and performances and stuff.
I think it could have been easily tied together, though. Like, because I was seeing it going in a certain direction. I was like, okay, this can be tied together.
I will say, though, like, Even the stuff I sort of liked, it's like there's no subtlety to fucking anything. Like the music choices are cringy sometimes. Like when they're like suiting up to go on their first battle and they're playing the Look Who's Back song by Eminem, or when they're in the helicarrier and they're playing Spirit in the Sky. It's just like, oh Jesus, or Super Freak when they introduce Harley Quinn. It's like, okay.
Right.
I 100% understand, like, why the reviews for this movie has been carcinogenic, because it's annoying in that exact way that most critics just don't have the patience for. But I kind of like when movies are anarchistic.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie almost is there. It almost has that Natural Born Killers kind of thing going on that I kind of dig, when a movie just goes batshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's a movie that it's not really at all like this, but for whatever reason, I'm going to compare it to?
Sure, go for it.
I feel like this movie would have been better if it had inched closer to something like a Seven Psychopaths.
Yes, maybe less heady, but yes.
Why? I mean, that movie is kind of fanboyish in its own way, just for a different genre.
I'll give you that. I think we're talking about the...
Sam Rockwell and...
Okay, yeah. We're talking about the same Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
In a few years. Same guy that did In Bruges, right.
Like, if you had done that movie, like, not exactly that movie, but that kind of structure, but instead of these new characters that, you know, were written, it were famous Gotham City supervillains,
mm-hmm.
that structure would work exactly the same way.
Maybe
some of the meta stuff you wouldn't necessarily have to do, but what I mean is, like, that movie deals with having lots of multiple characters and showing different kinds of psychopathy and showing, like, you know, making protagonists out of terrible people, but still making you care about them. Like, that's the kind of, like, anarchy that this movie almost sort of approaches, mm-hmm. but doesn't really have the nerve or conviction to stick with.
I can agree with that, but I guess I would go to the movie I would go to is Smoking Aces. I know there are a lot of people who think that's a silly movie, but this is a silly movie.
Right.
And for genre people, I think that Smoking Aces works as just a silly little throwaway action thriller thing. And I think that's what this should be, is
yeah.
basically there's a guy in a room and there's all these people coming after him. That's all.
I think it aspires to be something like that. I think that, you know, I thought about that movie too. I also thought about, you know, the Guy Ritchie movies that Smoking Aces was ripping off. So there's a lineage here.
Yeah.
And it wants to be kind of part of that sort of post-Tarantino thing. But the big problem is it's just not about a damn thing. Like, the movie is just so completely empty that all you're left with is a lot of aesthetics and a lot of noise. And, you know, some of it's interesting, some of it's not. And in the end, it kind of comes off as disposable.
I have a weird reaction because, again, like I said, there is a weird kind of entertainment to it, and there is something that there's something that is good in there. If for me, it's specifically, it's not even just like I can't say anything bad about superheroes, but there's something about it there that I do like, and I would actually want more of. But the entirety of it, when it comes to fruition, it just kind of dissolves.
Yeah,
and so, but there is a seed in there that I want. And mm-hmm. And again, there are characters in here that I would like to see. I would like to see the Joker more. Some of the ways that they shot him and did him were very creepy, and you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, see, you know, Jared Leto's getting a lot of shit. I think he's sort of become the Jar Jar Binks of this movie,
right.
Which is to say that we coined this thing a long time ago, the Jar Jar Binks theory, which is people don't like a movie for a lot of different reasons. But they can't articulate it exactly, so they just pin it on the most obvious thing.
Right.
I think...
might not even be the entire problem.
Right, exactly. Which usually it's just a symptom of other problems. Mm-hmm. But I feel like with him, I didn't love or hate it. A, he's not in it really enough to, mm-hmm. like, have a fully formed opinion about. And B, so much of it is just him kind of doing Heath Ledger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the voice is pretty much the Heath Ledger voice. A lot of the mannerisms are pretty much what he was doing, his kind of take on it, the sort of, like, you know, psychopath, sociopath kind of thing. Really all it is that's new is, you know, a purple alligator coat and a lot of tattoos. Like, and that's really all I can really gauge it on is the costuming. Which I'm not super into, but at the same time, I don't think the performance was, like, that bad. It just wasn't that original.
I can agree with that. There is a lot borrowed there. I mean, he is sort of... the one thing that I guess I would take a little bit different than Heath Ledger's or any of the Jokers that have existed is there's this just kind of baseline... I would say he's pushed a little bit further into to aggressive level. I think in the original Dark Knight, specifically with Heath Ledger's, there's kind of a trickster quality to him, or uh-huh. this is a full out, like, or this is a little bit less about the mastermindy and a little bit more about just directly stabbing you in the eyeball. But there is a very big similarity. So I agree with you with that, but,
mostly in the ticks, which
yeah.
from all we got, it was a collection of ticks.
Well, I guess there is supposedly, I mean, Jared Leto said that there's a lot more out there of his character.
No, I'm sure there is. This movie, like, it is the textbook of, oh, this was ravaged in editing.
There's supposed to be more of our favorite guy, Jay Courtney.
Oh, yeah, he was in there too.
He was in there. But I didn't. I will say this about that though, is I didn't completely hate him.
Was he the guy with the with the unicorn?
Yes.
Okay. I he did nothing for me really. Like not either bad or good. I was like, oh, he's the guy with the unicorn. Okay, he has a thing.
That's what I'm saying. In other movies, he's been
actively offensive.
Yes, and yeah. a detriment. And then the killer croc really liked how he looked, but
had nothing to do. I would love to see a killer croc movie with that physical appearance, you know, and get to see him really be killer croc. In this, he's just kind of a heavy.
I think we've reached a consensus. Our reviews sometimes mirror the actual movies. I always find that interesting.
Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework. It's 1985's Explorers, directed by Joe Dante. Why don't you go ahead and set that up?
Sure. This is about some children who basically one of them has a dream and says, look at the circuitry. And he takes it to the smarter kid who's, oh, this is actually a thing. And they start building this spaceship basically out in an abandoned field. And then they start discovering that what it can do and its possibilities. And this stars Ethan Hawke as one of the young boys who has this dream and is kind of the it's kind of the most adventurous of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got River Phoenix, who plays this weird geeky genius.
Science-y kid. Yeah.
Science, but kind of that 80s version of right. like super genius child who can make computers in their basement.
Right. He's a kid who he wears a lab coat and a bow tie. Like
there's some suspension of disbelief kind of stuff going here.
Right.
And then there's the third kid, played by a kind of a unknown. And he plays kind of a this blue collar, but kind of has some he really has kind of a mechanics kind of mind, and he knows how to build things. And
so what happens now?
I'll take us up higher and then they'll contact us, I guess.
About what's up there. I mean, what kind of life?
You mean, will it be some kind of slimy blob?
It could be anything. I mean, it could be pure energy, or it could be thought waves. I mean, I don't know. It could be something we can't even imagine.
How about a planet full of Amazon women who want to breed a new race?
You pervert.
Now, this comes post Goonies, you can feel that throughout the whole film, I feel like. Mm-hmm. It's sort of strange because this movie is like 80% character building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost the opposite. What it is they keep exploring the characters and they keep exploring. And then the ending and what you're kind of building towards is such a small portion of it that you kind of, it feels a little disposable in and of itself. I did realize towards the end, mm-hmm. when you get to this final climax payoff part, I realized I'd watched it.
Mm-hmm.
when I saw what they discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's the most memorable part, the rest of it is all this character builds and stuff like that. If you don't have them building towards something, I kind of realized this is a strangely different version, where most of the time you complain about it being empty and them not exploring the characters enough. This explores the characters almost too much.
I realized when we got to the climax, I guess it's supposed to be what they were building up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how much time was left in the movie. I was like, oh, this should have happened at the half hour mark.
Right.
And then your movie could have done something from here. So I agree. It's weirdly scripted. And I kind of, in a way, I could see how like a story like this could work maybe in like a short story or in even like a novel. Actually,
agreed.
Basically, this is Carl Sagan's Contact, with kids. Like, it's the same story. They might have even been inspired by it. I don't know. Not the movie, because it hadn't happened yet. But
right.
But the novel. Like, it, you know, they get these visions from outer space of how to build this spacecraft, and, you know, they end up learning a larger lesson about life and whatever from the whole experience. What I liked about the movie isn't necessarily the sci-fi angle, because I think there it's during a time when a lot of that stuff was kind of doing it better.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the characters once they become established past their sort of quirks or their archetypes. Mm-hmm. And I like how personal the movie feels. Like, if you know anything about Joe Dante and the way that he grew up, this feels so informed by Joe Dante's childhood, down to the B-movie stuff that's mm-hmm. playing in the background. He, you know, Ethan Hawke's character goes to sleep to the Saturday night midnight movie on TV, the, you know, these old kind of like giant spider movies and that kind of stuff. You know, at one point they go to a drive-in, and that's, you know, of course, that's the first place they take their spaceship.
Right.
And then, you know, the whole idea of, like, you know, these kids who are sort of bullied and they're sort of the outsiders in their school, and maybe it's a little heavy-handed, and there was a lot of that kind of being made at the time in a post-ET environment. Mm-hmm. And if you're comparing it to a lot of the films that came out around this time, you know, certainly Goonies wasn't even the only one. Within this 3-year period, you had Goonies, you had Batteries Not Included, you had Flight of the Navigator, which is very similar to this movie in a lot of ways.
That was another movie I was thinking of, but probably does this thing better.
Yeah, because that movie takes itself a little seriously. It has a bigger budget because it was Disney. And you had Stand By Me, which only came out a year later with River Phoenix.
Well, it also, with Flight of the Navigator specifically, they also had, it was a little bit more cohesive when it came to where the story went. Or mm-hmm. This is lots of character building. So much character building.
Yeah, well, I kind of feel like this movie, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that that was 100% intentional. I feel like this movie would have wanted to be more spectacular. I think there's budgetary stuff going on here.
Agreed. I also, kind of going back to what you were talking about, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
But I was thinking it also kind of goes back to his kind of hippie art school days as well, with thematics. Because instead of it being a xenophobic kind of alien, you know, fighting aliens kind of thing, they come in peace kind of. I kind of actually like the message. I think it's fun.
It's not the best of its ilk. And yeah. In the end, even though, like, how big these stars are and everything who are in it, it does kind of feel like lesser than a lot of those other movies. But I do think that it is very warm and it's very well-intentioned. And,
well, I think all of it's done very well too, because a lot of the jokes landed. It feels
performances are good for these kids.
You feel good throughout the whole movie, really. I was slightly baffled by how long everything was taking to build and everything kind of going along and their experimentation process and everything like that. Because
when you realize that the movie isn't about the special effects, it's not about when they get to go to space, because it's not like a you know, that kind of movie. It is more like Contact, where it's more about the process of discovery than the actual discovering.
Yeah. I don't think it works, though.
No, I agree. I think that that when they're in outer space and they discover the thing they discover, that should have been the half hour mark.
It should have been a half hour mark, and it shouldn't. The first act was the first, like, 2/3 of the film.
Oh, right.
And then the last little chunk, that almost felt like the second act, and it just felt like you never got a third act. The drunk guy from Gremlins, I don't know his name. I can't.
Dick Miller.
Dick Miller.
He's an old Corman actor.
He pops up in this again, going back to mm-hmm. to Joe Dante's roots in a way.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It feels very personal. That I liked about it. And I liked enough about it that I mildly recommend it. You are going to be reminded of better movies that came out during this kind of Spielberg Presents Amblin era stuff.
I think I would recommend it to a specific, like, our generation.
Yeah.
I don't think people older would maybe appreciate it as much. And I don't think people, I think people younger would just be like, what is this? This is sort of weird. And I wouldn't actively tell them not to. But at the same time, this is, I think it fulfills in a certain nostalgic kind of like warms those kind of areas of the brain in a strange way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Quirky sensibility.
It's not as good as Goonies, but it's not as bad as Mac and Me.
Well, that's true. No, that's true. And again, you're not going to leave this being like, oh, this is my new favorite. But it does have some, if you're interested also in kind of like character dynamics, it's kind of fun to watch at that level.
Right. Or just to see these actors when they were so young. And
yeah. If you're a big Ethan Hawke fan, I guess.
Ethan Hawke completist.
Yeah. I don't know how many are out there, but I like Ethan Hawke. I'm not talking shit or anything. I just...
All right. Well, what do you have for us next week? What's the Netflix homework?
For next week, we have SLC Punk Parts 2, Punk's Dead.
The sequel we weren't sure we ever wanted.
And we weren't sure existed because it just kind of fizzled into existence and out.
And right back out. Yeah.
But now it's on Netflix, which everything comes to light there.
Yes. That first film, SLC Punk, with Matthew Lillard, is very formative in my movie watching life. In fact, on the listening party, I just requested a song from that soundtrack.
Oh, which one?
Kiss Me Deadly by Generation X, because their theme this week was the word kiss.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what came to mind.
Well, that's fun.
Okay, so if anybody has any opinions about anything we talked about today, whether it be Suicide Squad or Explorers or SLC Punk 2 or anything we may have mentioned in the news, you can contact us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Listen to us and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as player.fm. And you can find our regular archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can read my movie reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also see some other things I've written for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Friend of the show, Brad Decker, who is going to be moving later this month to the Bay Area to become a theater teacher in a high school somewhere over there. He runs a entertainment blog called Panel and Frame at panelandframe.com. And our friends who also do podcasts, follow them, Leland over at dampercast.com, Rod and Denise, who I just mentioned, at The Listening Party, and Patrick, who's been on our show a couple times, at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational.
And there it is.
Bye.
Bye.